From St. Louis, Missouri, this is Strangers to Fiction, a podcast all about documentary storytelling by two documentary filmmakers. I'm Jacob McIndoller.
Hey, my name is Bill Streeter, and Jacob actually lied when he said we had two documentary filmmakers. We're actually joined by Bowles this week, and Bowles is going to tell us about the film that we're talking about.
Hi, my name is Bowles McLean, and the film we are doing this week is Brother's Keeper, the direct cinema documentary from 1992.
You just have to see this story. It's about the Ward brothers, Delbert, Roscoe, Lyman, and Bill, all bachelors who lived together in a cramped shack where they were born, in Munnsville. It's a small dairy town in central New York State. The Ward boys, as they've always been known, live the way farmers did 200 years ago. They never learned to read or write. They have no running water, no modern farming equipment. Nobody in town ever paid much attention to them until one day last summer, when Delbert was charged with murdering his older brother, Bill.
I'm going to go ahead and start this off, but I was very excited about this, talking about this film, because I discovered last week, Bill, from you, that you'd never seen this, and as somebody that, you know, has basically seen everything, I was very surprised, and this is, I think...
I haven't seen everything. Well, I've seen a lot of shit.
But basically, this was one that I was saying this to Bowles earlier. This is one that I rented from like a Blockbuster probably like in 1997 or something like that, and it has been since then one of my favorite documentaries that I've ever seen. So, now you've seen it.
I'm really surprised I've never seen this. I don't think I've ever even heard of this.
Really?
Before, which is surprising. I may have heard about it in passing. But, you know, the thing is that it's the first documentary made by this filmmaking pair.
Yep. Joe Berlinger and
Joe
Bruce
Berlinger
Shinofsky.
And Bruce Aronofsky, yeah.
Shinofsky.
Oh, Shinofsky, sorry. Yeah. Aronofsky, I'm thinking of.
Wrong guy,
yeah. Shinofsky, yeah, Bruce Shinofsky. And they went on, you know, a lot of people, if you're unfamiliar with this film, a lot of people will be familiar with their later work. The most probably the best known would be the Paradise Lost.
Yeah, Paradise Lost. About films, the West Memphis Three.
About the West Memphis Three. They went on to do this later, after this film. This was sort of their breakout film.
Yeah, this was the start. This was the first one.
Yeah, and then they also did the Metallica film, the documentary about Metallica.
Mm-hmm. Some Kind of Monster.
Yeah, and some other things. I think they both worked, done a lot of other things as well. I think they do commercials and
right,
a lot of other work, you know, like all other working filmmakers, they do whatever they can to bring in money, I think.
Right.
But, you know, they're brilliant. I think this is a brilliant film. I was blown away by it. It was...
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that.
The storytelling was so on point. It's a natural story there anyway, and the character studies...
are amazing.
...are great. It's beautifully shot, I think... All 16 millimeter.
Yeah, it seemed to be 16 millimeter.
Yeah. And, yeah, no, I love this film. I feel like this is one of those documentaries that becomes as compelling as any fiction film when you're watching it.
I was actually thinking about that on the way down, and I was thinking about all of the different characters. I mean, if we can start with just the brothers, because the four different brothers in the story, one of them has died, and then one is accused of his murder. Mm-hmm. But all, like, the three that are in the film, each one is its own, like, individual, complete character that could have... I mean, you could have written this as a fiction film, I think.
Yeah, well, it reminded me of a couple of different things. It kind of reminded me of, like, a Mark Twain story.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if Mark Twain were writing in the late 20th century America, he probably would have written a story like this.
Mm-hmm.
Because it had, like, all these elements of...
Well, the whole town knew him, which was always...
The
know,
big
surprising.
Government.
Yeah.
Oh, we should introduce Bowles.
I was going to say,
Bowles is here. Hi, Bowles. I was thinking about this too today. I think we should only ever refer to you as Bowles.
That's fine with me.
No other information.
So Bowles is also a filmmaker, but we thought we'd occasionally. We'll see how this works. Maybe we'll have permanent
might
people
be a bad
or
idea
whatever
together. Yeah, exactly.
But we'll occasionally we'll either occasionally bring in guests or we'll I don't know.
So then, anyway, Bowles, what did you think?
Well, I had I'll go through my history of the movie, which is not very much. I used to rent videos at Facets Multimedia in Chicago in the 90s. So this title went out frequently. It was a very popular HEP documentary. I did not realize I associated this with Paradise Lost. I didn't really look these guys up as I should have. I looked up some of the brothers and stuff, but I didn't realize these are the same guys that did that, and that mm-hmm. makes sense, because I really likened it to that, because it's that sort of rural...
Actually, I didn't know that either. I mean, this has been like one of my favorite documentaries for years since I watched it, and I've probably seen it a couple of times over the years. And I've seen all of the Paradise Lost as well, but I didn't realize until, you know, rewatching it to talk about it, that these were the same guys that did Paradise Lost. I didn't realize that.
No, they're brilliant filmmakers. I have mad respect for them, just because there's at least two of their... I haven't seen the Metallica film, and we should probably talk about that.
I've never seen it either.
Right, yeah. I've never
but I have it. Mad respect for these guys, because they have made two of my favorite, probably... I can't order my favorites, but both the Paradise Lost series, especially the very first installment of that one, and this movie, and I've only seen this one recently, are two movies that have blown me away.
Yeah,
this documentaries.
One, I'm so happy.
So they're master filmmakers.
Because there's I like everything about this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching it again today, and I was thinking about the pacing in the movie.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about a specific scene where, so one of the brothers named Lyman. Is the very nervous brother, right?
Yeah. The nervous brother.
Yeah, he gets really nervous, and I think we can talk more about that later. But the first time that they introduce him, he's so nervous, and he kind of walks away from the camera, and rather than just like cutting right there, they stay on him.
Yeah.
They watch him, and he's really nervously, like, he's trying to get into this barn, but there's like this wood door he's got to go, and you can just, it says so much about him as a character, the way he's trying to escape.
Well, and them as characters, like, what is that thing? And there's that board that boards up at their house, you know, their sort of makeshift house, and the way the squalor which they live in that they mention in the movie, just like, oh my God, people can live this way, you know, in this
and I guess we should probably set that up a little bit. So basically, you got these three brothers, and one brother died, one's accused of it, but these are like really rural farm boys that have grown up on this farm their whole life. The movie makes it pretty clear that they're illiterate.
Yes.
I mean, they can't really read, and they're kind of forced to sign these confessions that they didn't even know what it was.
They were asked to sign a piece of paper to make things easier on them, and that's pretty much sounding like the only information they were given. Aside from maybe some pose of what, but yeah, it kind of goes with this sort of culture that's on Netflix, which is now the Murder Network or something like that, 24/7. Whereas, like,
I love them all.
There's that coerced confessions show, and I was like, "Oh, this is just like this." It's
sort of a prototype for that.
It really is.
It's a true crime. Yeah. I mean, there's no getting around the fact this is a true crime documentary.
It is a true crime. But what I loved about it, and I was thinking about this today too, is it's a true crime documentary that doesn't try to solve the crime.
Yeah.
It doesn't try to tell you what the answer it is. All it does is takes a look at the people behind the story.
No, yeah, I love
provides
that
all the information.
And I think that's a really honest way of like doing this kind of stuff. I took the liberty of sort of looking up these guys, and it's funny. There's a lot, actually, if you're interested in these filmmakers, there's a lot of random interviews and things with them at different film festivals and things out there.
I saw a couple too. Yeah.
So I made a point of like listening to a couple of those longer form interviews that were done, you know, they're really done for the room in a film festival or something. So they're just videotapes. Somebody set up a camera in it. So not great quality. I happen to just listen to them like a podcast. Just turned it on, listened to the audio, cause the visuals don't mean anything. But these, interviews you should definitely check out. It's the thing that was interesting to me about all these interviews is that no matter what film they happen to be promoting at the like whatever film festival they're at,
it comes back.
They love to talk about this movie.
About Brothers Keeper.
Like they, they'll. It was funny. There was this one interview I was listening to at this film festival, and this guy kept trying to get him to talk about the Metallica movie, and they kept circling back to this movie.
The Brothers Keeper.
They did, and not the
they
audience.
They did.
No, that's
And it was and it was really interesting. They gave a lot of insight into how they made this film. So,
and I would be really curious of that, because it's hard to not watch that and wonder about how they made it in terms of just, because they're obviously they're not there before the brother dies. The first, you know, the what the story is about, but they're there pretty soon after. So it's like, how did they hear about this story? How did they, like, I would like to see them talk about how did they talk to those brothers? They asked the brother who's accused. Who is
Delbert?
Right. They ask him, you know, do you mind that we're making a movie about you?
He said,
nope. And he's like, nope. But I'd be really interested to hear that conversation when they first approached them.
So
and said, hey, you're going
here,
to
sign this. It'll be easier for you.
No, well, here's what they did, and this is a story they tell, and you can probably find, you know, these interviews, and you may actually, if you feel ambitious about editing, you could probably cut this part out and just cut in their part. But if you find that interview,
I probably won't.
But basically, the story they tell is they were both working for the Maisels brothers.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That's who you guys in New York, and one of them was sort of the sales rep, and the other one was like an editor.
Interesting, working on
stuff for them, and they kind of hit it off, and they end up hanging out a lot and talking, and they were like, had this conversation about how the Maisels brothers' best work is probably behind them. They were probably weren't going to have any big ambitious projects in the future because they were both getting older, and they're like, we should find something and sort of carry on this tradition of, you know, direct cinema filmmaking. And they so they both saw this story in the New York Times at the same time about this brother in rural New York being
New York Times did something, and
they both like had the same idea at the same time, and when they were both got super excited about it, so they decided to go up there and check it out, and they actually spent 3 or 4 weekends like going up there. It was a 4-hour drive from where they were at Manhattan, so every Friday night they drive up there. They'd spend the entire weekend, and they did it. The first 3 or 4 weeks was with no film equipment at all. They just went up and just hung out
and talked to them.
And they hung out, and they helped them with chores. They would go up on the weekend, and they would hang out with the four brothers, and they would help them with chores, and they just talk to them and just get to know them as people. And then they started going up with equipment, and then they only brought out the equipment when they felt fully comfortable about starting.
Wow!
And that scene where he asked them, Delbert, are you comfortable with us making a movie about this? That scene is the very first thing they shot.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And I loved just that whole scene, because they just ask him, like, what are you thinking about? And he's like, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just watching him. Like, just the simpleness of their life. And the way that I love the way Delbert even answers that question when they say, like, does it bother you that we're making a movie about you? Because if you watch it, because I've watched it twice in the last week, he almost answers before they even finish the question.
Okay,
They're like, do you mind that we're making? He's like, nope.
Yeah.
I think it's because they already had this conversation with him several times. And really, the person that really had they had to go through two groups of people to really sort of get access to shoot this documentary. And one was the lawyer, their lawyer.
Yeah. Their lawyer.
Delbert's lawyer, defense attorney.
Yeah, who I want to talk about because I found him very interesting too.
And the sort of there was this group of people in town that sort of made it their business to sort of help protect.
Was any of the protection because they're raising money? I guess that
it was the same people that went on to raise money for him and all that.
Were they raising any money?
Filmmakers actually had to get vetted by them and their those were the two sort of parties that they had to.
Because the interesting thing about the story, and it kind of plays out in there, is that where these guys were from, again, very rural place, and they were sort of outcast of that place. And even I think it's the prosecutor or maybe something makes the comment during it. He says that they were outcast in their town, but they were their outcasts.
Yeah.
Right. They belonged to that town. So that town really came out to support the brother. They ended up raising like $10,000. They raised $10,000 for the defense.
Yep.
And one of the things, every little character in this movie to me is so exciting. Like the older couple,
two couple,
who first raised the money, right? Yeah. And I love the way he tells the story. And he goes, He goes, I came home and I said, Mom, because he calls his wife Mom. He's like,
weird about that.
Mom, do you have your checkbook over there? And she's like, yeah, I do. And he goes, for Christ's sakes, make out a check for $1,000. Because we got to go help, you know, yeah. raise the money.
Delbert,
for this.
Yeah, which, my gosh. I honestly was surprised at the results, but yeah.
But then the same characters, even like a little bit later, I mean, they started the fundraising efforts, but they even talk about in one scene about how bad the brothers smell.
Yeah, exactly.
They're talking about like, well, if they came down to like the restaurant and they sat
I'm
next
not
to you,
sit at their
you wouldn't sit next to them because they probably haven't changed their clothes
booth.
In 6 months, they said.
Exactly. 6 months. You wouldn't sit in the booth after they'd sat in it even.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, well, it's like you coughed up a G for these guys, you know, which...
And the whole town did, right? The whole town came out in support of these
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, and the thing is that I don't think the town thought much of them before, and this came out in a number of different ways, but I think it's true. Like, most of the town probably didn't give a shit about these guys before and all thought they were a bunch of weirdos that lived out
there. Oh, I'm sure, because that's what they were. They were the outcasts.
Yeah, sure, they didn't want their
but as soon as the state police came after them, they sort of banded around them. And I think it's because they all knew that, like, I don't know.
They all knew they didn't do it, and they didn't want...
I don't even know. I don't even know. And there's an interesting question I have for both of you, because I don't even know if the town believed he didn't do it. I think a lot of people thought he did do it, but I think a lot of people looked at it as a mercy killing, because they talked about over and over in there about how when a cow is sick or when a cat is sick,
and there was that scene where they butchered the pig.
Well, there's some guys that seem to
and then, yeah, there is the scene where they butcher the pig, and that
which
scene
sort of
was like,
gave you a lot of context in terms of like how these people live,
yeah exactly.
and how they think. And I remember that scene, like the first time that I saw this years and years ago. I think that scene detracted from a lot of this movie. So I think a lot of people watch this movie and that one particular scene where they. Because they do it. I mean, they don't cut any corners. They show you
they show
this
you
pig dying.
Pig.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, that was so hard to like.
Yeah, I kind of wonder. Yeah, I mean, I watched it and I was like, I don't even know if you need this.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt. I felt like it distracted from the main story.
Yeah.
But because I
understand why it's there, and I kind of understand the thinking behind keeping it in there, but I don't think it needs to be there. And I feel like
I was a little surprised it was legal.
There's a lot of people who could watch this movie and enjoy it that wouldn't enjoy it only because of that scene.
Exactly. And that's what
and
I felt.
I feel like the movie itself could be bigger and better.
Oh, and I watched it with my girlfriend and said, you just turn your head during this part. And just, you know, for the whole I didn't even tell her what it was. I was like,
I don't think we need
And if you didn't have I don't think if you didn't have that scene in there, it'd still be a great movie.
People are I don't know if more people are more sensitive about animal rights issues nowadays than they used to be, or if they're just more vocal about being sensitive about it. Either way, I don't think
it
would
fly,
that you couldn't have that in a
would
even
not fly
a documentary.
Speaking of like now versus then, we were talking before we started recording about Harry Thurston, who's this guy who's like a neighbor, kind of.
Yeah.
He's a farmer as well, but he seems to be a more successful farmer.
Yeah.
And he actually, this character reminded me so much of my grandfather. Like, he just is exactly what my grandfather was like. But he gives a talk in there that I found to be like pretty progressive for the time and the area.
My
right?
girlfriend said that's progressive. And I don't think if he were born 30, 40 years later, I don't think the version of him that's walking around out there now remotely is that accepting of the...
So basically what it is that it came up during the movie that these brothers might be having sex with each other because none of them ever married. They're in their 60s.
Yeah.
They sleep in the same bed. There was some sperm found on the brother who died. So this comes up, and this guy Harry, the neighbor, says... You know, he goes, so what if they were?
Yeah.
He goes, where you boys are from New York City, you got all kinds of guys sleeping together, and they're not doing it just because it's a way of life. You know, they're doing it because it's joyous. He was like, who cares what people are doing in their bed? It was actually a very progressive take.
It was a very libertarian take, I think, more than progressive. Even.
Right.
And I think like some, you know, I think sort of mind your own business kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, if it happens in your house, and that's like kind of... You know, it's none of the government's business if nobody's getting hurt.
And really. And it has nothing to do with the murder either, for that matter.
Yeah.
Well, and they brought it up. So apparently, like the prosecutors kind of briefly introduced the idea that rather than a mercy killing, this may have been
sex gone
bad, right?
I don't think anybody was buying
it. And nobody bought it. And actually, even on the Wikipedia page, when it talks about that, it says the filmmakers never followed up with that idea. But I don't think the prosecutors followed up with that.
I would have loved to see some footage.
They sort of introduced the idea and they dropped it.
Yeah,
which is kind of bullshit. I feel like it's a police corruption story. I think
it is.
In a lot of ways, you know, it sort of gives you this insight into like, and I feel like a lot of these other Netflix documentary series that are out now. That one the True Confession.
It's
was
a
it?
Show. Coerced? I don't. It's
the Cold Coerced. I can't remember.
Confession, coerced. Something like that. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Like,
there's a couple of different Coerced Confession series on Netflix.
I can't
now.
Even keep it all straight.
Well, the whole and Bowles made a good point when you said that, like, the you know Netflix is kind of the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because now and I accredit all of this to the podcast Serial. I think that just launched this whole true crime like obsession.
Right. Yeah.
But so you see, and I love them. It's probably one of my favorite genres. So,
I've always been into true crime. I mean, I've always kind of like I'm a big fan of
and
like,
I think
true
this,
crime novels. And
I'm rather fond of it, too.
And I think this film and The Thin Blue Line, which we haven't yet talked about, were sort of the first seeds of that. You know,
right.
A lot
but
of films
two different animals, the style of the Errol Morris.
Yeah.
Contrasting, because this is the Maisley brothers. Maisel brothers, like...
Fly on the Wall is what you know. That's what they
right.
It's direct. It's direct cinema. Is
direct
the name
cinema,
there. Or cinema 16mm camera in your face.
If you listen to interviews with these guys, they talk about how they sort of feel like there is this kind of pure filmmaking. This is how they look at direct cinema, and this is the way the Maiselsburg looked at it. Is this there's this like idea of like pure cinema, like really just like watching somebody, you know,
let it unfold,
you know. And just capture everything and don't...
In front of your eyes, yeah.
Yeah, don't, like, sort of intervene.
Very great gardens.
And the whole idea behind the... They said one of the ways they sort of diverge from the Maisels brothers is that, in philosophy, is that the Maisels brothers always said there's no director in a film. Like, or in their films. Like, their ideal was not to have a director. And they're like, it's kind of like... You can't do that. As long as you pick up a camera and start pointing at things, you're directing.
You're influencing
directing
something.
Yeah.
I'd even say
so their idea. So they said they broke with them on that, and then they said that they sort of divide their work in between like sort of direct storytelling, which is like the Metallica film and this film, and then they have their advocacy films, and they consider the Paradise Lost films actual advocacy.
And that's an interesting thing that I found about this one, because I mentioned earlier how this one doesn't really take a side on what you know what really happened. They're just showing it, but Paradise Lost pretty clearly is taking a side.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
they're pretty
absolutely.
Clearly,
and they
picking
say
one
that
side,
they're
so.
Like this, they make a distinction between those two styles of filmmaking.
Right,
and
which
that is a different style.
I can
style.
Appreciate that. Yeah,
because this one, Brothers Keeper, is a very direct cinema style. It's just you're just showing what's happening. Yeah. You're not really painting a picture or telling a story.
Yeah.
But Paradise Lost is a lot of recreation.
Do you guys think that Delbert did it?
I don't actually.
I don't. It's hard to really. It's weird because at one point, I guess, and it's the buddy with the artificial leg. Doesn't he show him how he
wraps his head? Yeah,
he wraps his head. Can you do? I guess they're demonstrating if Delbert did it. You know, if I did it, then this is.
I thought it was like he asked him like what the cop showed him.
Yeah, and he said, "Can you show? Can you do it on me?" So what he does basically is,
and that's how he did it. Or
Harry
like
the neighbor.
Yeah,
he's standing there, and then Delbert wraps his arm around the back of his head.
That's a pretty creepy scene.
Comes around,
and Harry is mumbling and joking,
and Delbert's like laughing. He's got like a big grin on his face, but he's covering up his mouth from behind. Now, when I watch that. I mean, wouldn't anybody struggle? That doesn't seem like he didn't have him pinned to the floor and choking him out. It looks like if you were sleeping, Bill, and I like came up behind you and I put my hand over your mouth, eventually you would like not be able to breathe. You'd catch your breath and you'd wake up and you'd kind of very quickly and easily.
I thought that very, William. What if you were very sick though?
But he doesn't.
Yeah,
but what they say
they
is
say
he wasn't
William
that
could
sick.
Across the room. You
but
know,
he wasn't that sick. So the idea that's painted is he was sick. But then Harry, again, the neighbor, made a comment. He goes, I've known these boys 50 years. He goes, I've never seen Bill. Bill's the brother who died.
Yeah.
I've never seen Bill not be like knocked around a little bit. Like his ankle sometimes hurt, or his knee hurt, or his shoulder hurt.
Cut himself.
Like he wasn't
with a chainsaw.
Cut himself with a chainsaw.
Why was that not questioned more? I'm like, where?
It was great. It was great the way the brother
he just cut himself. I'm like, details. You just can't leave off chainsaw.
Yeah, because the brother says. He cut himself with a chainsaw many years ago, and that's always bothered him.
Yeah.
And they ask, well, what happened? He goes, couldn't turn it off. So what happened?
Cut himself.
cut him. They just go, cut him. That's all he says. And I'm like, and you're like, what? Yeah. What? Where did it cut him? Where on his body?
Yelling
where?
At the screen saying, yeah, you got to tell me where in the leg and blah, blah, blah. You know,
yeah, was it on
know.
The leg? Was it on the arm?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
They never mentioned it. It was cut just like, nah,
it's all you need to know. Cut himself with the chainsaw. Well, it would be a funner story if you kind of elaborated more.
And that was Roscoe.
Yeah.
Like, so Roscoe's one of the brothers.
Yes.
And he was the one that also, what I found really interesting about him was he couldn't hear.
Oh.
So he couldn't hear, so he had really bad hearing. So he'd like lean up to the filmmakers whenever they asked him a question. He'd be like, what? You know,
it was a back and forth because it was like, you know, I did admit initially within 2 or 3 minutes. I think most documentaries that come out now would absolutely be subtitled out the wazoo on these guys.
This
I turned
be.
On the subtitles, yeah. And I was like, all right, you know, an intelligible mumbling, you know, was mainly what was going on, you know, and I was like, I really couldn't have I couldn't have even grasped probably a tenth of it without reading a lot of the subtitles.
Yeah, and I was talking to my wife about this, you know, before we came down, and my wife is not a native English speaker, so I was telling her how much I loved it, but I was like, you probably wouldn't enjoy it because you can't really understand these guys very well.
You could, and Netflix, you can turn on the subtitles.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, could have done it. I literally would be. I mean, I even think
you guys don't want to know if I think you did it.
Bill, what do you think? You think he did it?
I think he probably did not do it. But here's the thing that I thought was interesting. One of those interviews, one of the Joe said that he actually thought that Dilbert probably did it, I think is interesting.
Was Joe? There was a guy in a restaurant who's a younger man. Was that the guy, or is there's a?
Well, there was a guy in a truck. I remember who a neighbor that they interviewed, and he said, well, and he said, you know, I think he probably did do it after everything that came out. He probably did do it. But probably he did it out of mercy. So even the people that thought he did it didn't really care that he did it. Like they were like,
yeah, and you know,
you're putting down a dead or you know, a sick dog, basically.
Well,
the way they looked at it.
I mean, the big thing for me was, and this is what I thought was the big tragedy of the thing, is the cops really shouldn't have been prosecuting a guy like that without a advocate on his behalf to begin with, because he is not. He obviously did not have the faculties of the intellect.
He's not educated.
To
I don't think there's a big concern
understand
down
what
in,
was happening.
And Harry
and
makes
I
a
think
comment
that was
in there.
A real injustice of it.
It was. Oh, and Harry made
you're
a comment
looking at a town that doesn't have those kinds of that kind of thinking. You know,
no, they
I don't think
the cops
are smart
I,
enough to identify how.
But
dumb
I think they
that
did
is.
Have that kind of thing. I think the town had that kind of thinking. I think the
sure,
cops
sure, but the cops just wanted. Do the cop thing.
I mean, I think that's what the town came to the defense because they're like, those boys don't have the sense to put two and two together. They can't.
And the truth
be
is
like
that they, the truth
way.
Is that they didn't. And Harry talks about that. He goes, Delbert went in there and waived his rights. He goes, he doesn't even know what it means to waive his rights. No. He goes, he doesn't know the difference between that and waving at somebody walking down the street. Right. He doesn't know what it means. And then there is the brother that was very nervous.
I mean,
nervous.
They're severely... I mean, if you haven't seen this film yet, I'm sorry about all the spoilers, because you really shouldn't.
Oh, this is all
that's
spoilers.
Their fault, yeah.
But...
screw them.
But, you know, I mean, the real issue is, the whole thing, is that these are four brothers that live together. They're very severely mentally handicapped.
I have a question about that. So, I would have really loved... They didn't talk about this in the film, but I would have loved to if they went in a little bit deeper into what their parents were like.
Because oh, absolutely.
Especially when I saw Lyman. Yeah. And Lyman is, I mean, it's not a stretch to think that he looks like an animal that's been severely abused.
Oh, yeah.
He's okay. So skittish. Yeah. He's so scared. He's so nervous that I came away going, this looks like somebody who suffered a whole lot of abuse when they were younger.
Right.
Probably, I would guess, at the hands of his father. I don't
know. Scenes where he's testifying on a stand at the end.
It's heartbreaking.
Excruciating.
Because he cannot talk. He's like just... Yeah. Shaking up there.
He's
on the
bad
screen.
Enough on the side of a dirt road talking, and then he's there, and he really can't function.
And the judge has to end up just like taking a recess
and
give him a break.
Here's a little fun fact: Dilbert died in about 98. What about maybe five? Maybe about 8 years.
Yeah, a few years
after.
Later. Yeah.
All right. So that kind of test, that kind of to me shows that Bill could have just passed in his sleep at whatever 65, 66, whatever the hell they're mid 60s, and they look like they're 86. Lyman. made it to 2007. That blew my mind.
Well, here's, like, how did that guy here's even 80, more interesting.
88 years old. Or
here's not, not only did Lyman, but Roscoe did. And yes, Roscoe died in June, and Lyman died in August. So he died just 2 months after his brother.
I didn't catch
died.
That. Yeah, I did notice that.
After his brother was gone.
What's that?
I bet losing his brother.
I mean, his final brother. God, and he was sort of, I think he was. He might have been the youngest. I'm not sure, but he might have been the youngest. But he was also obviously the most sort of psychologically damaged in some way. Yeah. You know, I don't know if that was.
Well, I think there are two things going on. I think he had some psychological damage, but all the boys had some very severe learning deficiencies.
Yes.
I'd wondered in the 50s range. You know, like that's.
I wondered if their parents had shared too much DNA.
Oh, maybe they're inbred.
I mean, think of what it looks like. That's exactly what we don't. It's like that Stephen King thing, you know. Or
and I like and this.
I mean, that's a possibility too. I love the idea that film. I mean, you say you wish that kind of stuff was in there. I kind of like the way the film leaves that.
A lot of that. It just raised those questions in your mind.
Kind of thing that makes you think about the film for a long time.
Exactly. Because you drive around going, what were their parents like? What were they, you know?
And sometimes, like, knowing every little detail, like, sort of takes all the fun out of it.
And it would have taken away from what I really liked about it. And it was that it was just the direct style. But if they did start in the film diving into what their parents are like, well, now you're given a reason for all of this.
Right.
You know? And I'd rather just let it play out the way that it played out. So.
And I think the whole, with the style of filmmaking that they're trying to follow, is that the whole idea is that it's a very present, like one of the rules, the way they limit themselves, is it's a very present form of filmmaking. They aren't going to go back and do anything. Unless somebody on screen starts reminiscing, there's no going back just for the purpose.
Because the only going back they really did here was to look at news clips that were talking about
the case. Right.
Yeah. But even most of those were sort of doing it presently in that moment.
Yeah, like, and they were shot.
I thought they were watching it, a broadcast. I was amazed to see Connie Chung making an appearance in this movie.
Yeah,
they were saying, I was just watching it again, and I think I had missed this before, but they were talking about Lyman and how nervous Lyman is, but then when Harry, the neighbor, told him, hey, Connie Chung's going to come. Apparently, he just, like, lost all of his nervousness suddenly until, they dealt with Connie Chung, and then he got it all back when he went into the courtroom.
Right, exactly,
Like, I've never seen him so calm, but talking to
Connie Chung was a huge news icon at the time, so a big journalist icon at the time.
So I have,
Chung, like, if you, she would have been, like, she's on a level like Mike Wallace or somebody like that.
That was a huge crescendo in her,
Oprah.
Notability.
So I want to bring up another character in this. Like, I don't think you could have written a better villain either.
Oh, my God, no.
Than the medical examiner.
Yeah, yeah.
The medical examiner, who you don't see until, I would say, like, almost like the late second act.
Yeah.
And you only see him testify in court. He's not interviewed for the film.
Oh, yeah.
But he is, and if you watch this, and I guarantee you, if you watch this, you're going to see this, he seems like a character that's being played by Woody Allen. Seems like Woody Allen pretending to be a medical examiner.
Yeah, right.
And he is so pump, and he basically launched this whole thing off, right? Because Bill had died, and he came into the medical examiner. The police didn't suspect any foul play, but the medical examiner found some
dots of blood
in his lungs and stuff like that that indicated that he may have been suffered.
None of that stuff would seem believable to me at
but the
all.
Way
nor,
that,
nor irregular
the way he,
for the circumstances of a guy that might have coughed and died in his sleep either. Like,
yeah,
you know,
could have been,
a
yeah.
Particular person. Especially as a genetic mess of a person, you know. We don't really know what's going on inside that body. I think anyone could be coughing up blood or whatever but the hell.
A medical examiner's name, I wrote it down here, was Humphrey Don Germanic.
Oh, gosh. And he
spells
it out.
He spells
it out.
What's that?
Did you look to see if he's still around?
I didn't look him up, but he just was so pompous. Like, he thinks for sure, certain that he's the smartest person in that room. He thinks that he knows way more than everybody. And the way that he explains things, and it's not that he explains them incorrectly. He explains them correctly. It's just the way that he does it has such a condescending tone. Like, where he's like, I need to explain this to really dumb people. So I'm going to talk like I'm an elementary school teacher. And he just... You just hated him, but you couldn't
It's true. Yeah, there's no way you're like, oh, screw you. Anyone could, you know. I'm not a medical examiner, but I diagnosed this as an accident just by hearing it, you know. But then what am I? But yeah, it's.
But he was such, to me, just like the villain of the story.
Yeah.
And, but you don't really meet him until later. And I guess we can, since we...
He's a villain. I think the state police are...
They're the police, but you aren't really dominant. And they really don't make their presence in it that much, per se. They just, you just kind of hear a lot of word of mouth about their... I guess this was also not explored. The... do they want to sell their property to a suburban rich? I don't know if that's...
I didn't really understand.
So this was another
I didn't really understand.
Hey, by the way, we're investigating some problems. Is this land for sale by any chance?
Right, like, so one of the takes that's sort of explored in the film is that the police might have kind of accused Delbert of doing this because the land that they owned was in an area that was going under like suburban development.
Yeah.
So that it was going to be very valuable to a developer who wanted to build you know, a subdivision there
so
or something.
So the theory was, and I didn't completely understand because I didn't understand what the motivation would be on a part of the police per se, but I could see like some third party maybe having some influence with the police.
The police officers were thinking, I think what the way it was depicted anyway, is that the police officers were going to try to buy that land off of them because they thought they were dumb, like, you know, country bumpkins. And then they would turn around then and sell that to a developer and make a big profit off of it.
That's what almost was proposed. Certainly not brought up twice in the documentary.
And it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't ever developed.
And I was like, well, let's find out if they're asking around.
I didn't really understand. I don't know. I wasn't necessarily buying that as motivation. I believe that the cops were definitely trying to railroad this guy.
Yeah.
And I think that there was sufficient doubt to even start a prosecution against him. I don't think they even should have started a prosecution against him, mainly because of his mental state.
How are you going to get that confession to stand up?
Yeah, I mean, he's a little kid. He's literally like a 4 or 5 year old kid.
And they live in filth. They might have cancer. That's another thing. Well, he might have had cancer too. Mom, dad had cancer.
They call it the cancer.
Exactly. They might have the, you know, and
mom died of the cancer. I mean,
they both died, so it's like, well, you don't.
I just didn't necessarily buy the motivation that people were coming up with for.
I didn't either.
I think the cops were probably railroading him just because they thought it would be an easy case.
Sort of the land grab theory was, along with the sex gone bad theory. They were both kind of introduced, but they never really explored that. Yeah. And that one didn't really come out at trial. I don't even think the defense attorney was using that as in the trial. He wasn't going these people just want to grab their land. I think that was kind of just town gossip, you know,
You don't think it was not even explored that much? I guess it must have been explored a little bit. The cops did explore sex gone bad, right?
Yeah, I guess they did. Because they said, one of the interviews that Harry, again, talks about how Bill's body was held for 2 days so that they could do a rape test on him.
Right.
And they were looking for sperm.
That's right.
As
all they would have found was...
And I think that whole thing was bullshit, too. I think they were just trying to they're not buying the mercy.
And they did
story.
Find sperm. They found it on his pants.
Now, I was curious.
How would you know what you found on their clothes?
Their clothes are certain. Who's and whose
did
sperm
you see
is that?
They
never tested for
did
who
you see that shot where Lyman was walking away, his pants?
Yeah.
Multiple colors of streaks.
There's... They're 6 dirt. Months
they,
worth of
yeah,
oh
they said
God.
They didn't change their clothes
how
for 6
you know,
months.
How would you know he had anything on?
And you know, you wear a pair of pants for if I wear a pair of pants for 6 months, it's going to get sperm
if
on
you,
it somewhere.
Yeah,
like
if you,
you know?
if
by
you,
hook or by crook.
Yeah, if you would have excavated their clothes for any substance, you would.
You
probably
could have
found
a lot of piss
it.
And shit on
find,
it. And,
yeah,
you know.
They could have. Yeah.
So.
So the whole sex gone bad thing.
Well, they would
sense,
not
right?
have. They, I don't think they would have had technology. They certainly. Well, maybe they could.
And you know
they
what?
Could test for sperm. They couldn't test for anyone significant singular's sperm. You know, there's no way they could figure out.
I don't know. That's a good question. Could they at that time have tested to
dead
like a
sperm
DNA test
and say, well, it might be this guy's. You
they
know,
could
but
do DNA. Yeah, they
have no
DNA,
DNA
now, but they. I think
none.
Even then, getting DNA sample of something on the surface of his body would be so contaminated.
Oh.
Even now, I don't think it would make any sense to do a DNA.
I don't
test
think that really happened until the late 90s where they could pinpoint.
But
DNA
I mean, nowadays
person
they can't.
Person.
They still that's the big myth of DNA. They try to make it seem like it's infallible, but really, there's a number of places where DNA can go wrong.
Yeah.
And one of the things is if they get a DNA sample from a contaminated crime scene. If you came in here and took a DNA sample off this couch,
you could find my DNA.
You could find all kinds of people's DNA.
And it
wouldn't make any
pinpoint.
Sense.
You could probably find DNA of people that weren't even in here if we sat on something and brought it in here.
So
I think
I mean, if you can get it from DNA, I think DNA makes sense for like somebody who's been raped and you're taking a sample from their
from the actual
vagina, mm-hmm. then chances are you're going to find a significant sample and it would make, I don't know, I don't want to get into DNA, but I feel like DNA gets a lot of, like it's this magical evidence.
I think that's partially, so swept even, under the carpet over some.
But I think they were, I mean, I thought the whole like medical examiner show was just like bullshit because the medical examiner didn't know shit. He couldn't look at like they handed him like I didn't understand. They handed him that bag of evidence like it was all these
and
like,
he starts looking at like he's an idiot, like
in bottles labeled in a bag like how is that like he's not in a laboratory. He's not going to start opening up specimens and examining them for the
those were specimens? I had thought and I was thinking because
they were all like.
I had thought they were his medication to show that this guy could drop dead any second, but no. I guess I don't know why.
They were just going through. They were just like showing him. Like I didn't understand that. Like
you're right. They were.
It didn't make any sense. You know, like this is all. I don't know. It was. But
the way that he even took that bag. So what they do is they cut it, but they cut it into like where they show all of the different. Witnesses that are on the witness stand, each one is examining this bag. All right, and then when they get to the medical examiner, he just gets this like look on his face that is just like, what is this stupid bullshit that you're making me do here?
Right.
I don't know what, like, I'm too good to sit here and look at this.
But I just hated this guy. I hated this guy so much. I think came from the fact that like he was like, this is a, I think, and he came off as like. This is how I read it because it, to me it was like it didn't make any sense. Like, why would you hand somebody like a bag of specimens on the stand as if they could say
as if they could
anything
determine
about
anything
it
from it? Yeah,
on the stand. And I felt like he, to me, I read his reaction to that is like his, he sort of had some skepticism about the process himself at that point.
Yeah, right.
He was just like,
they show everyone and everyone's
really
like,
you're handing me a bag of like specimens I need to look at in a lab.
So I guess honestly, since we're doing spoilers, we can say he was eventually acquitted. Which was the right.
Yeah, which choice. Is the right. But you know, honestly,
well,
I feel
based
like,
on the evidence, especially. I mean,
yeah.
say
I mean,
it,
the movie would have made it would have been a great story and a great movie either way.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. It I think it would have been a lot more disappointing and frustrating had he been convicted.
Yeah, probably,
you know, then it might have become a cause. You know, then it might have become.
Well, and I think that's kind of how they ended up doing that. Like. Thing they said that they're on the record of as of saying that like you know that might like part of the reason the Paradise Lost story became a advocacy sort of project was because they were so outraged themselves by the outcome of that trial. They were going to follow it in a similar way,
and that's one we should do sometime is do the Paradise Lost trilogy,
yeah,
because it is a trilogy.
I think we need to do an episode just about the Maisels brothers, just kind of an overview about the Maisels brothers, because I feel like they're.
I still haven't seen anything they've done.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
well. All right. Well, we should all.
I know.
Make
well, there's
a
this
point of watch.
Just watch documentary now. You get the whole gist of their career, but in 11 minute segments.
But it's so Salesman is the one I know that they did Give Me Shelter, which is
that's Rolling
Stones.
Rolling Stones, which is
yeah,
really good.
I've seen that on the big screen.
And Grey Gardens, I've never seen either.
Oh, so. Jesus! Well, this is Grey Gardens Part Two, pretty much. You know,
really?
There's a certain oh god, yeah.
Except that there's no
well, there's no murder mystery, but Grey Gardens is that's I mean I was
the
watching,
character stuff.
I was watching it with my girlfriend. We're like we just kept referring, kept talking about Grey Gardens in the midst of it. And she's like, "This is worse. You know, these people are worse than what they got in Grey Gardens." Like, I know. Who'd have thought? You know. Because one thing is about this movie that's so really almost far more fascinating than whether or not he mercy killed his brother or a cat was the way they lived. And I loved roaming through that apartment or roaming that house and seeing. And they got a school bus with chickens.
It was like an animal.
Yeah, they got a school bus with chickens.
I mean, it was literally their house looked like an animal den.
Oh, it was disgusting. It was dirty. There was
And my girlfriend's like going on and on how she. And I was just like, I
that
would love
that scene where
to
he was talking
there.
About how terrible it was to be in jail.
Yeah,
and then they pan around the apartment.
I know. Exactly.
Yeah. They ask him the question. They go. They said, and I don't know if you noticed. They said, "Have you ever been in a place like that, like about jail?" And he's like, "Nope, never." But that's when they pan around. They're like, "But this is the place that you live in.
Know,
how bad could jail have been?"
There's
just so many
it
brilliant
was so
moments.
Amazing.
In this
I don't know. You guys probably saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right?
I have not. Yeah. But it keeps coming up, and every time we have a discussion,
well, it's going to come up again because I think almost direct influence was probably when he goes and sees George Spahn at the George Spahn Ranch Same place. It almost looks exactly the same. It's got a working smaller TV on a broken lower TV. It's flies flying around. It's mess everywhere. Huh. And I was like, and same thing. George Spahn was like, couldn't hear. What? You know, he kept saying he had to repeat everything. And I was like, oh, yeah. He's just like one of the, I was like, oh.
I feel like their actual house is way worse than even that set.
Well, sure, because that's real. I mean, that was fabricated. But there's a lot of little touches of similarity that I thought really
their house
might have had a hand.
That was
in
the
it.
Thing Maybe that not. Came to mind for me is that the house was not so much a house as it was like a burrow.
Yeah, it was a place to sleep. That's all they did.
Yeah.
And they farmed. I mean, just where they went in and they watched their TV.
Yeah.
Right.
And they ate and they slept. And it wasn't like a home that they really lived in.
Well, the one guy
never burrow is kind of a good thing for it. Yeah.
Well, the one guy had never been in there. He said,
no, he said he'd been in there two times in 50 years is what he said.
Oh, inside the house?
Yeah.
So right, but he had been we talk out by the barn. He hangs out outside. That who knows what's going on inside there. He was there watching TV with him, with Connie Chung.
Yeah, at the end.
And
yeah,
I was like, wow, look, he's inside. I thought he'd said he never, but I guess if you say 2 in 50 years, I guess that makes sense. But yeah, he had that you just kind of, they just muster in there and they let the filmmakers in there. Thank God. But
can you imagine how cramped and like tight that was for the filmmakers
in
there?
Right.
They especially back in the 90s, they had probably pretty big, if they were just shooting 16
millimeter,
they had a pretty big
camera.
They had
a Nagra and a camera.
Yeah. Nagra and a camera, no doubt.
They got to have probably somebody running a mic as well. So
yeah, the guy with the Nagra probably was running the mic.
Yeah, it was probably, two-man crew.
Well, I'm very, very, very happy that you both loved this.
I thought it was great. It was, like I said, it reminded me of a Mark Twain story, you know, like a Pudd'nhead Wilson kind of story, or, you know, it could have been, I could see this being like a story that the Coen brothers might fictionalize.
Yes,
great. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Got a Coen.
There's a lot of big
that just gave me
that
got me excited.
Of,
a Coen brothers version of Brothers Keeper would be great.
Yeah, there's wonderful. These big themes that sort of. I mean, I could see somebody adapting this to be a play. It's that dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you could
and contained.
Yeah,
it's all in one spot. Or
yeah,
whatever.
And you could be. It's this movie transcends just mere documentary. It's as dramatic as a film as there is in terms of character, in terms of story,
and very little one.
And it was beautiful too. I feel like there was some point during the trial, like I had to like shake my head and think, this is not completely fake, is it? Like,
right.
I was like, am I getting punked here?
So
like,
much of it
I had
seems
to look it
fake.
Up to see if it wasn't a hoax film, because it felt so much like. It was so dramatic, it felt staged at points, you know? I don't know.
And that's the thing, all the characters are so interesting, the characters almost seem written.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, how do you get a brother that shakes that much on a witness stand?
Well,
like, that just seems like...
That guy would
I've never met a person like
that
before.
That guy was in Nowhere Land. Do you think... Beach Nut was very excited when this movie
came out. I actually thought about that. It almost seems like it was sponsored, like there was product placement from Beach Nut
thing.
Tobacco. Because you see Roscoe at one point shoving his mouth full.
Label,
then they show like
label
a big,
out like a television advertisement, takes a chunk out of the Beach Nut, which you hear.
And holds it up, lifts it up to
it
his
up,
mouth so you see the whole
it's
bag.
Right there on microphone. It's like the music stops and gets I can taste it in my mouth. I haven't tasted that stuff since I was 11. Whatever that stuff tastes. And then later, there's a great billboard for Beach Nut, which I've never seen in my life. I've never seen a chewing tobacco billboard on the side of the road.
You're too close to the city, man. You got to go out a little farther. You'll see him out there.
Get lost. But I was like, wow, that's like, you know, hey, if you're putting disgusting, syrupy tobacco leaves inside your mouth for the future of your cancer mouth, try Beach Nut, you know.
And that was one of the moments, though, actually, that Beach Nut when he's putting it in his mouth that I just loved about the pacing again. So, again, it was like when Lyman was trying to escape and get into the barn. You had that Roscoe where they're asking him some questions, and he doesn't care to the fact that he's on camera. So he just holds up a big bag of dip and just starts shoving it into his mouth and still kind of half-answering questions while he's doing it. And it just and rather than like cutting that out because it looks like sloppy or whatever, they just left it in. So that tells you
character.
Well, it tells you so much about the character of who that guy is. Yeah. No. And I thought they did such a great job of just all
and
of
that's
these
like,
characters.
Yeah, and I love that style. I love the them doing that. And you know, I feel like a you know, that's I love this whole style of documentary and this you know, that started with the Maisels, I guess, mm-hmm. sort of helped create this direct cinema approach to things.
And this is,
I think, a lot of people do a lot of hybrid stuff nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
But and there's validity in all of it. It's all good. I mean, it can all be done well, and a call can be done
well. And I mentioned I mentioned the Thin Blue Line, and you were saying how that's such a different thing. And we should discuss that someday because it is a totally different way to tell the story,
right?
But it's like you said, it's just as valid.
The past, so that I think the difference is that this direct cinema approach is telling the story in real, not in real time, but they're following the story in real time and telling that, you know, they're literally.
Letting the story tell itself really is what they're
doing. Well, they're literally documenting the story as it unfolds.
Yeah.
Versus Thin Blue Line, where he's having people, it's doing a presentation about the past.
About the past, right. So he does recreations and people are interviews.
And it's very evocative.
Yeah, and this whole idea of direct cinema is that, like, you know, this approach to documentary is it's all about, like, telling something in the present,
and when they get it, like they did on this, like they got it so right, you know, like
yeah.
I mean, I think that's a hard way to tell
a
documentary.
Well edited,
yes,
I think, yep. And I'd like to know how much footage they shot.
It's a hard way to tell the story because
they'd have to be shoving in every 10 minutes a new mag, and for that court, I mean, we saw a good what is that about 5, 8, 6, 8 minutes or whatever of court scenes.
I think there's even more than that. Whole basically third act is basically the
so maybe court. 15 to 20, but they would rifle through. And all they have is some smattering of what went on during the case, obviously. And then the closing deliberations and the read off, and then they just, you know, flash to the douchebag and obviously Lyman having two attacks.
Yes.
I mean, what they excuse, they recess for the day, come back, and
they should Lyman, never back. Lyman.
He shouldn't have been on that stand.
They shouldn't have. I mean, not only should he not have been at that stand, the only reason he was on that stand is because they did something else they shouldn't have done, which is even charge Delbert with the crime.
Lyman signed
a confession, too, that said that Delbert killed Bill. But he didn't know how to read. When he was on the stand, they kept asking him the question, would you like to change your testimony? And when they asked him that question several times, and if you pay attention, it's very clear to me that he doesn't know what would you like to change your testimony means. And he just, and they kind of keep asking him, he just kind of goes, and finally he just goes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he doesn't know what the question is.
Yeah.
So how do you
testimony is in the signature, not what he's doing right then.
It's even one point where they ask one of the neighbors. And this just kind of goes at, like, the intelligence level of the people in that community and why they shouldn't have been there. But they ask one of the neighbors when he's on the stand to identify Delbert. And he points to Delbert, and just for the court record, they say, the gentleman with the gray beard. Mm-hmm. And this guy's like, what? What?
Yeah,
they say again,
yeah,
they go, the gentleman with the gray beard. Yeah. And then finally the judge steps in and goes, is it the man with the gray beard? And he goes, oh, yes. So it was clear that guy didn't know what the word gentleman meant. Like, they were asking him, he didn't understand.
Oh, do you think it was a hard of hearing thing? Or
no, because
I thought it was
comprehensive.
I think it was at first, but they asked it repeatedly.
Yeah. Gentleman.
And he didn't get it. And
I
then
think
finally
it's a combination
of
him being hard of hearing and being old and easily confused.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think
and in a situation that he's never been in before. Yeah. This guy's never been in a courtroom. He's never been on a witness stand.
They don't know what to say or what they're flabbergasted by the whole thing.
I feel like the whole thing was a miscarriage of justice. They shouldn't. They had no business trying to charge him.
They shouldn't have charged him, right?
Well, I think with these anything, things go on all the time. And I think, like, you know, I knew a guy. Well, I knew people who knew a guy that got busted in middle Illinois. Basically, sometimes they just want somebody to prosecute to show the town that they did something.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a show.
The coerced. Yeah.
They're justifying their budget,
and you get prosecutors who want to, like, have, you know, get a little attention, make a little name for themselves.
Yeah.
You get a medical examiner who wants to make a name for himself.
They got an election coming up, and you know, they want to show they're being tough on crime, so they find somebody they can charge with.
I was shocked that
easy conviction.
Delbert was not as familiar with Hunter, the TV series, as much as they made it out to be earlier in the documentary.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't like that one too much. Like, are you kidding me? You don't like Hunter? I think you
Yeah, so
like
one of the theories by the prosecution was that this guy, he definitely understood what Waver's rights meant because he watches like a TV show about like a...
Matlock?
Kind of Matlock. I don't even know what Hunter is. I've never seen that show, but I guess it's similar to like a Matlock.
No. Hunter is a television version of Dirty Harry, in which the... cop who looks very much like Dirty Harry would always, at the end of every episode, unload his huge pistol into the bad guy and just riddle him with bullets. And, you know, he was a little out of line, but, you know, he had to get the job done. The guy was not a good guy in every episode, except for two-parters where he does it at the end of the second
episode. More ironic that they were saying that Delbert understood basic police procedure
because he watched that show. Agreed. And he's like,
no,
the
show that doesn't follow police procedure.
You mean the one where the cop like unloads his weapon into the suspect at the end of every episode?
But I really would with this film. I think you could put this up against any fiction film.
Oh yeah, it was so good. I cannot believe I've never heard of it, and I feel like it didn't get enough buzz when it came out.
Well,
but obviously, I think that launched their career.
Yeah.
And they'll say that they've said it.
I heard
anybody listening, if you haven't heard these guys interviewed, there's tons of stuff on YouTube. You should go.
Yeah, I want to go watch it. Now. So we should say that one of the guys has since passed away.
Okay, one of the filmmakers.
One of the filmmakers passed away.
Oh, he did. When? Which one?
Not Joe.
Bruce.
Yeah, Bruce passed away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
My iPad died, or my laptop died.
Do you think it was a mercy killing from his brother?
Joe killed him out of mercy? No, I think it was...
I did not know that Bruce had died.
Yeah,
Bruce
Shinofsky, I think is his name.
Okay.
Yeah,
he passed away.
I didn't come across that.
Too
bad.
Back in the... I don't remember the year, but...
About 61 or 62, right?
Yeah, and I think maybe the cancer... Maybe the cancer got him.
The cancer that his mom and dad had when they were brother and sister. Now, one interesting you said enough. One thing I did see an interview with I think years later, but he said and some other people. But the movie when it came out or when
he died in 2015.
Everything's done and said. They made about $2 million off this documentary.
$2 million,
and they shared the
profit.
They made sure, yes. And they, as far as I know, they said they made about $2 million and they shared it with the brothers and made sure all the brothers were buried in a plot together. And they shared the money with them too, whatever
that's
it was. One,
well, they did. Yeah, they said they cut them in for some of the profits.
Yes.
But here's a funny story that I heard Joe tell in a couple different interviews. Joe told the story about how they were, when Delbert died.
They got
a call and they said, "Hey, can you come up and speak at his funeral?" And they were like, "Oh yeah, we should probably go do that." So they went to speak at their funeral, and Joe says that they assumed that they would be one of many speakers among many speakers at this funeral. They got turns out they were the only people that are going to be speaking at
really?
The funeral.
The only people alive. Yeah. I mean, all their
and there were about 10 or 15 people at Delbert's funeral. And they spoke, and then afterwards, what's it? Their neighbor's name with
Harry.
Harry called them over and said, "Thank you very much. We really appreciate that." And then handed them the bill for the funeral. They didn't know.
Oh, that's
really
awesome. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Here's the bill for the funeral.
Here's the bill for the funeral.
And that was only 98, so they had some scratch. What do you think the bill for that? What in 98? What do you think a bill for that would have been?
It probably would have been $10,000 or $15,000.
About 12 G's.
So. A cheap funeral, maybe six.
Maybe in that podunk town.
Well, I mean, it's good of those guys that if they did.
So anyway, they thought, like Joe thought that was hilarious.
Yes.
and said, fine.
Fine. Yeah.
And
good for him.
Then they decided to go ahead and buy the rest of the plot so they could all be buried together.
Oh, they're buried together. Oh, that's interesting.
So that came after this. So they had no intention of paying for anybody's funeral, I don't think.
No, but they gave money during it.
But they did. They gave them...
Which
give
was probably
cut. For
Delbert.
Yeah.
That's probably some loosey goosey
money.
Because those boys never had any money.
No, they took the money and they built another silo on their farm.
Okay.
The money they gave them.
Okay.
And then the silo got knocked down like a year later in the storm.
No.
Those brothers cannot catch a break,
had hookers screw themselves.
I like
to death.
That. Yeah. You know, there's the one scene in the movie where they like throw a party, a kind of fundraising party.
Yeah. First time you ever danced with a woman. Yeah.
And there's so many great moments in that. There's Delbert before the party where they go, "Did you shave for the party?" And he's like, Yeah, yeah. Took some of my whiskers off the party.
Delbert. That's not Delbert.
Oh, is that Roscoe?
It is Roscoe. Roscoe. He's like, I tried to shave my... And like, yeah, dude, that's like, a terrible
he's like,
shave.
He's like, I didn't get all of them. Did you use so your he's hand? Got like just huge patches of like hair on his face. Yeah. He got like some like bald places. But then when Harry talks about it too, he goes, because you know, you got these things down there. You know, they're having this party. Delbert's dancing for the first time in his life. He goes, nobody's ever thrown the Ward Brothers a party in their whole life.
Yeah.
And they don't know that it's to raise money to get them out of this trouble.
Delbert didn't even understand what it was for.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy had a mustache coming out of his nostrils. I mean, he shaved, he did what he said to shave part of the face, which he didn't do a very good job at all. And then there was a bush coming out of his nostrils. I thought, oh my God.
I was wondering, how did he shave? Like, they didn't look like a razor. It looked like he took a pair of clippers or a pair of scissors and just started like chopping at his beard and trying to get it as low as possible. I think as low as possible.
Chunks of skin missing on some of it, too. But yeah, I love the panning through just all the wood paneling inside this movie. You know, that style that never looked good. And they said, yep, this is what things look like now. Yep, wood paneling, potato salad, just that part.
And some barbecue venison in the crock
pot. Barbecue venison, yeah, exactly. We've got homemade
shot. The whole film was just beautiful.
I loved it too, man.
It was just the way it was shot.
Do you think, I thought it could, I mean, I think they're first time filmmakers. I didn't think the cinematography was as glorious as much as effective. I wondered, though, if what I'm watching, if there was a
4K...
Well, I thought it was adequate, but I didn't think it was phenomenal.
I think the transfer...
Do you think the transfer could be better? Do you think a 4K
I think that might have actually been a... from a film to SD transfer.
Yeah, I felt that I wasn't watching...
The Netflix version.
Yeah.
Film to SD.
I would like to see a...
yeah, because I would think Criterion could come in and whatever they do, they got to the original masters.
Yeah.
And I think there were, you know, in terms of technical filmmaking, I liked it because I just liked that style of the fly in the wall. But there were moments like where they were interviewing people in like a coffee shop or something like that, where you couldn't hear them well because there was like too much background noise going on. So I think that's probably something those guys learned over time, you know.
Yeah, I felt there's a learning curve. I didn't think anything. Well, these guys suck.
But I wasn't at all.
I didn't think it was a little schlocky at times, and I wondered. I'm like, because I was like, this is adequate, and it's not great. Now, obviously, they're dealing with some stuff and they're learning. This is the first thing, but I wondered if the transfer was hindrancesome to. What it could
no, I think look so. At. I absolutely
wondered
so.
That too.
Yeah, because I feel like it, I think it's a SD
133. Yeah, it's like a 133 aspect ratio still, and they could really, if they really hammered that on 4K, you really get some of the rich.
Yeah, like, it would be details. I thought that the things I thought were particularly beautiful were the shots outside of the farm where they're walking in the fog,
right?
And things like that, which is beautiful, and then the stuff at the end. Where they're on the stand in the courtroom, the courtroom scenes I thought looked, it just putting those on film, just the fact of seeing that stuff on film
gives
it this patina of like, it's almost a theatrical thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like seeing like video clips of people giving testimony,
well, just
gives a completely different feeling.
Connie Chung being watched off of TV
I like the color of it, and I like the subtlety that you get in the film. And it's so rare to see documentaries from the 90s shot on film like that, you know. Like, this is an early 90s documentary.
It's early 90s. Yeah, yeah. I mean.
And there's only, you know, you have to have a significant budget to shoot on film in the 90s.
You're watching money just fly into the toilet, basically.
So,
with mags of film that
I don't know what the first great video documentary was, the one that was actually shot completely digitally, but or not even digitally, but like
databatable,
VHS or something.
But well,
probably, yeah.
Yeah, that's something we should look up. But I don't know. I thought it was a beautiful film all the way around. I thought the cinematography fit perfectly.
What needs to be seen is a 6K restoration, just to see inside their homes and really see the crime on the walls.
It would be nice if they did.
Over like, this is like, this, no art director put this together. This is four people's filth, and they're like, the ceiling's got leaks coming in, and they're like, the house is waiting to die, and all the occupants in it are all dying together.
I wonder whatever became of their land.
Oh,
They didn't have any children. None of them ever married. They were asked about in the film, like, do you want to get married or would you like? And they're like, I wouldn't even have a woman around. So they were probably the end of their line.
Yeah.
So I wonder what happened to that
line. And there was one cousin, the girl. There was a cousin girl.
Actually was a sister as well. Wards had a sister.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, that was their sister?
So the sister is not in the film because she had already passed away.
Okay. Sister cousin.
But she had a sister, and I think it was somebody. I believe it was the sister's daughter, maybe, that appeared in the film.
Yes, something his cousin,
like
right.
Yeah, something like that that appeared
and
in the film.
And she started getting emotional because cousins, and I'm like, well, what? We should find that farm and just.
Well,
I want to see where that chicken bus is.
Well, I love this film, and I'm so happy you guys loved it. Really excited. I was so excited that when you and I talked about it last week, I went home and watched this again that night because I was so excited to talk about it.
And you'd seen this about 25 years ago,
I've seen it many years ago, and I've seen it a couple of times in between. It's always been one of my favorites, and I'm so glad you guys loved it. I'm glad I can turn you on to it.
Thanks for turning us on to it.
Thanks for inviting me to the podcast. I enjoyed it.